All right, let's do this. How are you? What the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fuckocrats? What the fuck publicans? I don't think there's a lot of you, but I'll say hello anyways. I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Welcome back. Get out of here. Whatever you need to hear. So today on the show, John Doe is back. That's what he's up first. He's the lead singer of the band X and was on back in 2015, episode 586. He has a new movie out, so it was a good time to have him back. And Rodney Crowell is also here. He's one of the biggest country music singer-songwriters out there, not just for himself, but for other artists as well, like Jerry Reed, Guy Clark, Emmylou Harris, Bob Seger, Crystal Gayle. He's had 5 number ones on the Billboard country charts and 2 Grammy Awards. And he's just most recently produced a record with Jeff Tweedy of Wilco. It's called The Chicago Sessions, which is great. And it's one of those things with him where, you know, I didn't know about Rodney Crowell. I'd gotten a few of his records here and there sent to me, and I didn't know how to contextualize them, where to place them. And then I was at Willie's 90th the second night when Keith was there, Billy Strings. And Rodney Crowell came out with just a guitar and did a song, and it fucking was devastating to me and had so much presence. That was also the night I had the Dave Matthews revelation that I didn't want to have, which was that he's a very talented and charismatic and engaging performer. He also stepped out there with just a guitar, but I've kind of compartmentalized that. There's something I'm still refusing to accept about Dave Matthews as a whole thing. But Rodney Crowell, just like I was crying. And, you know, that's not hard right now, the crying. It comes. It definitely comes. But these guys are on. I'll talk a little bit more about my relationship with country music in a minute. Los Angeles. Hey, I'm at the Elysian Theater this Friday, December 15th, and next Friday, the 22nd. I'm at Dynasty Typewriter on Thursday, December 28th, and I'm at Largo on Tuesday, January 9th. Now, those shows, like on the 22nd and the 28th, they might be just me and you, whoever you are and the few people you bring. But look, we'll work it out. I've got to work it out. So if you want to be present for that, I would come to those. And then I'm in San Diego at the Observatory North Park on Saturday, January 27th for 2 shows. San Francisco at the Castro Theater on Saturday, February 3rd. I'll be introducing a screening of McCabe and Mrs. Miller on February 4th at the Roxy in San Francisco. You can get tickets for that at roxie.com. Portland, Maine, I'm at the State Theater on Thursday, March 7th. Medford, Massachusetts, outside Boston at the Chevalier Theater on Friday, March 8th. Providence, Rhode Island at the Strand Theater on Saturday, March 9th. Tarrytown, New York at the Tarrytown Music Hall on Sunday, March 10th. Man, I'm going to be driving to those, I bet. Yeah, I'm probably going to be driving. I wonder if it's going to be snowy and freezing. Probably. Atlanta, Georgia. I'm at the Buckhead Theater on Friday, March 22nd, and I'll be in Austin, Texas at the Paramount Theater on Thursday, April 18th as part of the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets and, you know, come out. The other thing that I need to talk about briefly is that I discussed something on the show the other day that, this was shattering to me. It was a brutal reality where I know that I'm a bit of a mark. I know that I'm a bit of a sucker. I know that I'm compelled to things that'll fuck with me emotionally. You know, whether it's I don't do it on purpose, but certain movies, certain commercials, certain people, it's how I feel. It's what makes me feel. I can generate stuff from the inside, but I like the stuff from the outside. So I talked about this phenomenon of reels on Instagram, as usually where I watch them, of interspecies affection and love and care, you know. And I talked about this amazing video where a giant shark delivered a sea turtle in trouble to a boat, to a fisherman, had a netting around its neck, and it couldn't breathe properly. And the shark pushed it to the boat, and the fisherman cut off the thing off the net, and it went away. And, you know, everybody's crying, not a dry eye in the house. And I thought it was so amazing this interspecies, like, what does it imply about the world of wildlife where they do have this experience of caring for each other outside of their species, you know? And turns out, I don't know if I'm grateful for this or not. Some woman DM'd me on Instagram, said, you know, she went to one of those sites to check the validity of the video. Not real. Not real. It's a mashup of three different videos. And I just, my entire reality came unglued, untethered. I was lost in the world, floating freely through space with no hope. I thought, you know, it looks like that turtle got saved in whatever situation that it was in, but the shark had nothing to do with it. I don't know, maybe in the first part of that video, that shark was trying to eat that turtle. I don't know. I assume they didn't eat them. I don't know. But does this mean none of it's true? Does this mean that the kitten and the monkey, that's not true? Does it mean that the crow didn't push the hedgehog across the street? Does it mean that the duck with the kitten isn't true? Does it mean that, like, the doggies and the kitties and the ducks, they don't really hang out together with love? Does it mean it's all fake? Is that what's going to happen in the future? It's just all you're going to doubt everything other than what's right in fucking front of you. You. Even there, but that's a different other. Yeah, you can doubt that, but, you know, that's organic. But do we got to doubt everything? I guess we do. I guess we do. Or we just got to let it flow over us, take the feelings that come, try to parse them, hope they're not dangerous, and move on with our life. Oh, look, you guys, I'm doing what I can here. So John Doe is a good guy in a great fucking band. I saw X not long ago. They're doing a new record. They're back out on tour a bit, and they still fucking rock. And I can't say that about most bands, even my favorite bands, but X is very specific. They are their own thing, and it's a great thing, and they fucking rock. So I couldn't help but talk to John a bit about that. But he's got a new movie out. It's a remake of the movie DOA. He plays the lead, and you can buy or rent that on all digital on-demand platforms. This is me catching up with the legend, John Doe. So, okay. So now you text me and you're like, they're remaking DOA.
Yeah.
My first thought is like, why?
Because it's public domain.
Is that it?
Yeah.
No shit.
Well, that was one of the reasons.
Yeah. I had no idea that movies can become public domain.
Yeah.
What's the name of the guy who made it?
Kurt St. Thomas.
Yeah, because I'm doing research. I'm watching the movie. Like, where does that? How did that come together?
Things do, just weird circumstance. So Kurt's made a couple other movies. They went straight to video, and he's actually known for radio. He worked at WFNX.
He worked in Boston.
Yeah,
I remember back in the day
with your buddy Tony V. Wasn't Tony V one of your old pals from Boston?
That's right. Of course he is. Yeah. He's like the main guy.
Yeah.
Like he's still there. He's like one of the guys that everyone reveres and respects. Yeah.
He's a celebrity there.
But I remember WFNX. I remember like that whole scene back then. Yeah. That was the alt-rock station before alt-rock existed.
Yep.
So he's probably playing your music.
He did. Kurt also booked a Green Day show outside and like 20 or 30,000 people showed up because it was like just as they were starting, but it was kind of like when Nirvana just blew up
right.
overnight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like 20 or 30,000 people showed up and they thought they were going to be like 2,000.
So he's a radio guy. He's made a couple movies.
Yeah. And so he's living in St. Augustine, Florida.
Oh, how's that?
And his mom lived there. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful old town.
Yeah.
And as he's walking around there, he's thinking, like, this looks like a movie set. This looks like the back lot from, you know, Warner Brothers or something.
Yeah.
And then he reads that DOA is public domain. And what does he hear in his head? He hears the X song where we name off the band names. Like,
yeah.
What about the Flesh Eaters and DOA and Big Boys and Black Flag?
Right.
And he thinks, DOA.
Right.
It's a sign. I'm going to call up Doe.
Wow.
Doe is DOA, you know.
Yeah, he's been hanging out in Florida too long. And brain's getting mushy.
Right. But so we played there in 2017, played in St. Augustine because it was like 40 years of X.
Yeah.
And Kurt comes up to me and says, hey, man, what's going on? La, la, la. We'd exchange pleasantries and start going. We went out after the show and he goes, I'm going to remake DOA and you're going to be the guy.
Yeah.
It's like, what?
Wow. Went,
sure.
Yeah.
Like, I get to be the guy?
Yeah.
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 Count me in.
It's your, you're the narrator.
I'm the man.
The main guy. Yeah.
So it's kind of like, I mean, and to be honest, I thought this is never going to happen.
Right.
But it did.
Yeah.
And when, you know, like with Warren Oates or Harry Dean Stanton, you know, I'm not that class of actor.
Mm-hmm.
But having been in a bunch of, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're in a bunch of shit.
Yeah.
And some of it's good and some of it's terrible.
Sure.
And, but you're always just the, you know, some other, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
If you get a second name, then you know you're doing better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, if you're Bill.
Yeah.
Not so
great.
Good.
If but everybody knows you, and you.
If you're
you
know, Bill Jones, then you're a little bit higher up in the you know.
Pecking yeah, order, so. It's just funny because I remember but, now because like I watched it a while ago, but like Pinfield's in it.
Yeah,
it, you know he's got these like primarily radio and music guys.
Yeah,
doing a lot of stuff in there.
Yeah, Jake Labatz is in it.
What's he from?
He's a guitar player, blues player in Chicago.
Yeah,
and but you know I got to be the guy, and that was really rewarding. It was. Shot on a shoestring. It was, you know, it's like legit film noir because
right.
all those things, like they did them in 10 days.
How long do you do it? How long did it take
them? Like 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
All digital though, like he didn't.
Well, it was, one of those Sony Red cameras. But the cinematographer is a legit guy. He did, you know, a bunch of Iron Man 2 and he's a serious DP.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know what I'm talking about when you get to be, you know, and so.
What do you mean get to be way, like if someone asks you to do a movie and you think like, how long is it going to take? Where is it at?
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, all right, I got, that seems fine.
Yeah. How much, or as Robert Bishop used to say, how much do I have to fall down? but you know, it's
you had a good time.
And it's very punk rock because it's all DIY.
Yeah.
You know, right now it's streaming on, you know, Apple Plus and Google Play and all these kinds of things. So it's,
did you end up, because I remember when we first talked that it just seemed like, you know, pulling a screening together was a difficult thing out here. Did you get it out?
Yeah. Yeah. We had a premiere up at the Los Feliz 3.
Oh, okay.
It was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we won a bunch of awards, like smaller film festival awards.
Okay.
25.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
And so we did the film, you know, circuit, and then we're going to do another screening maybe in January, February up in San Francisco. We did one in Boston. Actually, I was supposed to go to the one in Boston, and they diverted my flight to JFK. I missed the whole thing, but Tony V stepped in, and he was like, everybody loved him.
Sure. He's Boston.
He's fucking Tony V.
In Boston, that's sort of like, the comedy sort of like the dance hall circuit in Texas.
Dig it.
They're guys that are, you know, definitely regional, and he's definitely one of those guys. But he's one of those guys that all the young guys respect still. I mean, you know, I just did a big thing out there with Dennis Leary, this benefit, and I came up in Boston as a comic. And there's definitely kind of these acts that are just... they're just animals. I mean, they're like they're just road warriors and they can just do the thing and they've been around forever and it's always great seeing them. Yeah. But it seemed like some of them are old school and Tony sort of influenced what would be more of a punk rock alternative long form thing. Yeah, it gets a lot of respect.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was was Dana Gould part of that too?
Yeah, Dana left early. Dana started when he was like a kid, you know. When he was like in his teens, but he went to San Francisco, you know, fairly early. So he knew all those guys when he was like a kid almost, but he got out and really, because I don't think, you know, Boston as a scene was that hospitable to what he was doing.
Right.
Because, you know, he could do anything. He's sort of an interesting character, very dark guy, but he can, you know, song, dance, mimic, you know, voices.
Yeah.
And he's very brilliant, but it's, you know, and at the core of it is some darkness.
Yeah. Well, isn't that the core of all?
But he was one of the first guys that would bring it out. I mean, usually you're it's assumed.
Right.
But your job is like to hide it.
Yeah.
You know, or to sort of make it palatable, but he would go right in.
Yeah.
I still talk to him. He's great.
Yeah. Good writer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really he was a Simpsons writer. Guy for a long time.
Yeah.
Did you ever do a Simpsons?
No. Yeah. Not famous enough.
Oh, come on.
That's okay.
Yeah.
No, I'm not. That's fine.
Yeah.
That's why we still have cred.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We never had like the one hit and the dumb haircut.
That's true. But like, you know, you
Well, we did have a couple. I did have a dumb haircut. But that's
Which
okay.
one? Which dumb
I had
haircut?
A flat top with Fender. I had a flat top with where you grease back the sides.
Yeah, but well, that's back now.
No, sort of dumb.
Yeah,
but doing this movie was awesome.
Yeah,
you know, because we really had to like get favors done, and we went to the or Kurt went to the St. Augustine Films commissioner or whoever.
Yeah, sure.
Said I want to pull some permits to make a movie here in St. Augustine, which is a tiny little town.
Right,
the oldest city in America.
Yeah.
And he said, because he had done some shooting in L.A.,
yeah. you know,
where it's thousands and thousands of dollars to get a permit, right?
Right.
And he said, so how much is the permit? He said, $35.
Come on.
For how much?
Yeah.
Anywhere you want. For a month or longer. It was $35 fucking, $25.
And it looks good. It's a weird, pretty place.
Yeah. Oh, it's got all the Spanish moss. It's very, very, you know, it looks creepy.
Yeah.
And we got alligators in it.
Yeah. Got to have alligators.
Got alligators. Got pretty women.
Sure.
Yeah.
It had all the things that it needed to have.
Got femme fatales and also like creepy business people.
Yeah.
And there's,
sure.
you know.
Yeah.
The writer, Nick Griffin, I got to mention him because Kurt did a couple of passes on the script.
Yep.
And I'm reading it going like, yeah, but the story doesn't make all that much sense. And I said, hey, I've got a pal.
Yeah.
Whose favorite movie, and is a legit screenwriter, and his favorite movie is Chinatown. Do you mind if I give him a chance? And Nick had all these great lines.
Like, yeah.
One of them, the Tony B says.
Right.
Actually, when he's holding me as Jake LaBotz is about to pummel me.
Yeah.
And Tony B says, don't fight, it'll go quicker. And I was like, that's like philosophy. Like, I need to apply that. We all need to apply that to our lives. Don't fight. It'll go quicker.
Yeah, because it could be either, you know, a sort of spiritual thing or
exactly.
something just to accept death either way, right?
Yeah.
So Nick Griffin, what has he done?
He did Matchstick Men. He worked on
That's right. I knew I know the name.
His brother's a pretty hot shit writer. He also did a TV series called Terriers. Mm. Which was pretty good with Donald Logue.
Oh, yeah.
I think it only lasted like one or two seasons.
I think Donald Logue is in the lumber business now.
What?
Yeah, he's got some, I can't remember where he lives, but he does that thing where you get repurposed wood. And, you
oh,
know,
yeah.
He's got like a company that does wood.
Smart.
Sure. It's like in Montana or somewhere. I can't remember. It's been years since I talked to him, but he's dealing in that. I forget. It's not is it repurposed wood? Like,
yeah,
I forget
like what found.
Yeah,
found
recovered
where,
wood.
They pull a cypress log out of the swamp
right,
or something
right,
and then
yeah.
cut it up. Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, those are like tens of thousands of dollars to get a plank.
No, I know. I mean, it's not. It seems like it's a good business, but, you know, actors are interesting, you know, because like, you know, when they're not working, they've got to figure out something to do, man.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, musicians can all play. Just go play. What are you going to do? I'm bored. I'm going to go play. Yeah. Let's do a show. Yeah. Actors are like, I don't fucking know. I got to do something to make my life interesting. Jesus Christ.
I always thought that's why actors were a little sideways.
Some of them.
Because they can't just go do their thing.
No, but they're sitting around. They got to, and then if they're relatively famous, I find that character actors are more interesting because they know the score. You know, they're going in, and they got to show up and do this supporting thing.
Yeah.
And usually they're much more interesting characters. But the ones I know, they're kind of, you know, like John C. Reilly, Toby Huss.
Yeah.
I know Pat Healy, who was just in that Scorsese film. Mm-hmm. And these guys have to, you know, they generally lead, I think, more interesting lives. Like either artists or they take photographs or they paint or whatever.
Yeah.
But like Stephen Dorff's another one. He's out in Malibu hanging around.
Right.
I think if you're going to be an actor, you better enjoy free time.
Yeah.
I can't take it, man. Sitting around in that trailer. Fuck.
Oh, I know.
Should you bring a guitar with you?
Oh, yeah. Always.
You do?
Oh, sure. But the thing, it's interesting because when you do get those like 2-3 scene parts, you know that you got to go in like ready and like on.
It is. Yeah.
And that's the hardest thing. You're sitting around for like fucking 10 hours.
Right.
And it's like, go.
Yeah.
Like, what, now?
Yeah.
Yeah, go.
Yeah. You've been waiting 8 hours to do this. You've been in your trailer for 2 days. Yeah. Are you ready?
Yeah, I know.
And you got, that's a concern if like you sit in the trailer for 10 hours and you got one scene and you're all amped up, you know, and you come in with too much energy, but it's easier to work down than up.
Yeah.
So, but you're in the whole movie.
Yeah.
So you kept moving, right?
Yeah.
What were you doing? Like 8, 10 page days? I mean, how did it work?
Oh, easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Easy. But I mean, luckily my character wasn't like huge pages. John Byner.
Yeah.
The
comic.
Legendary comic.
Yeah.
You know, being the bad guy, which was a total coup.
Yeah.
And he's so understated. He would do a full page, just boom.
He's been around so long. He was a perfect choice. You know, it's nice when you see these guys get a little work.
He has a great line as well. He says, "Great thing about this country, there's always more." And, you know, right after World War II, because this is set in the, you know, period, set in 49.
Yeah.
It's so great. And it's like deadpan.
Yeah.
Because at that point, there was always more. Great thing about this country.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now it's more. Great thing about this country, we're running out of time. We're running out.
Let's not go there.
All right, buddy.
It's too sad.
Yeah.
It is. It makes me sad. It makes me really sad.
Everything? Climate, politics?
Yeah.
People?
Yeah.
Consumerism? Capitalism?
Yeah.
The whole fucking, the drain? Everything we knew was coming is here?
Yeah.
Everything we were most afraid of is happening.
Better or for worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that why you have a half a hammer on your desk here?
This is random stuff that was in the old garage. You remember the old garage. It was all cluttered with all kinds of crap. So then I had most of that stuff's up in the house now. Yeah. So I had to pick random things that were around.
No, it's good.
I found that hammer somewhere.
This is like the scene, the set of a film noir. It's got a freaking folding knife.
Yeah, yeah.
Slit your belly open.
Yeah, I got a slide. Whose slide is that? I got a couple of slides, I think. Yeah. Derek Trucks gave me one, but this is, what's his name? Ben Harper.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's good.
And Charlie Musselwhite gave me some dirty harmonicas. That's what you want. Here's a harmonica.
Make a Charlie Musselwhite out of that if you had the technology.
You sure could. You can make a whole army of Charlie Musselwhite. We might need to soon. Well, I'm glad you're doing new things. I'm glad the new record, the movie's exciting, and people can see it on Apple TV.
Yeah, or YouTube.
Yeah.
YouTube, Google.
The new
Play.
DOA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
what are the expectations? How's it? I guess he sold it. So did you make some money or did you?
No,
make
that's
money
why
back?
That's why it's video on demand.
Okay. Oh, so that's
we went
it.
To
so
you know video. We went to a bunch of like indie film distributors and said, well, I don't think we can get it on this, and we probably can't do it on that. We could get it on video on demand. It's like we can do that ourselves, motherfucker.
Yeah. Well, it's good seeing you. Good talking to you.
Thanks for the invite.
Thanks for the T-shirt. Thanks for the movie.
And the,
maybe we'll get some people to watch it.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy.
All right. Thanks.
All right. DOA is available to buy or rent on all digital platforms like Apple, Amazon, and YouTube. And to talk about Rodney, you know, with me in country music, I did grow up in New Mexico. There was country music around. I remember watching Hee Haw. I think it came on before the Walt Disney Show, or maybe it was the Porter Wagoner Show. But I didn't grow up in the world of country music, and it's something that I've had to backload. But as I've said before, there is no late to the party. There's constant revelations. There's constantly things being revealed. There's things you can find. Music and most everything else happens all the time, all at once, out there in the world. No context. But I certainly love country music, and I've grown with it, and I'm always trying to find new country music. I mean, here on this show with Rodney, he talked a lot about Guy Clark. I got to get started on Guy Clark. But also just Crowell himself is a hell of an artist. And he came up, with Townes Van Zandt in a scene, you know, down there in Nashville. And Townes Van Zandt's another one that, you know, I came too late, but is it late? And it's heavy for me. Townes is heavy, man. I can hear the weight of the world in his voice, and sometimes I can't take it. But, you know, he also, Crowell, you know, has a relationship with Willie and was married to Roseanne Cash. And it's just, there's a history there. And ever since I watched that Ken Burns doc on country music, it gave me the arcing context. And I still buy a lot of country records, a lot of old country records. I just bought a record of Bobby Gentry and Glenn Campbell together, and it's great. There's always things revealing themselves coming down the pike, and it was great because Rodney actually was playing down the street from me the night that I talked to him, or maybe the day after, and I got to see him do his thing, sing his songs in an intimate space, and it was kind of great. The Chicago Sessions is Rodney's new record. It's produced by Jeff Tweedy. You can get it wherever you get your music, and this is me talking to Rodney Crowell. What's your primary guitar now?
My primary guitar is a 1932 Gibson L00.
Is that a smaller body acoustic?
Smaller, it's a 12 fret.
Oh, wow.
12 fret acoustic. They call them tuxedos.
Okay.
White pickguard.
How old is it?
It's 91 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, and I play it every night.
Yeah. Yeah. Where'd you pick that up? Did you get it at that big place? What's that place called?
No, a gift.
Oh.
It was a gift from my buddy Sterling Ball.
Uh-huh.
Ernie Ball strings and,
okay,
and Music Man guitars. That's,
oh, yeah?
He's my good friend. It was his son was getting married.
Okay.
So I came out to sing a song at his son's wedding.
Yeah.
And he was a godfather. He was in a tuxedo.
Uh-huh.
And I was telling him about this 34 L00 14 fret that,
uh-huh,
I tried to steal, I tried to buy, I tried to shame this producer in Nashville to giving me the guitar.
Yeah.
And I was giving this sob story to my friend Sterling about, you know, man, I tried to buy it, offered him $10,000.
Yeah.
So he got up and left.
Yeah.
And came back in the room with this 12 fret.
Oh, my God.
Handed it to me and said, shut up.
That's a big day.
It was. It was a godfather moment, you know. It's like.
And that's the guitar.
It is. You know, the thing is about guitars and me, all the guitars I play were given to me.
Right. That's what you try to do, right?
It wasn't intentional. I was working with this guitar player.
Yeah.
And oh, he plays guitar with this guy.
Yeah.
So he offered me $10,000 for the 62 Strat that I had that Marty Stewart gave to me.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I bought it off Marty Stewart for nearly nothing.
Yeah.
And so I was working, and this guitar player said, you know, God, I don't have a Strat. I love Dominic Miller. He plays guitar with Sting.
Okay.
And we were working on a Beth Nielsen Chapman record, and he said, you have a, can I borrow a Strat? And I said, I got one.
Yeah.
So I, in the middle of the sessions, he came to me and he said, I'll give you 10 grand for this guitar right now. And I said, man, a guitar's not for sale.
Yeah.
I said, I can't sell it to you, but I knew then that I was going to give him the guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
So I waited an hour or so, and I said, you know, I can't sell this guitar. I said, but I can give it to you.
Yeah.
And so I did. And he said, man, every time you see me with Sting, I'll be playing it.
And
almost every time, television or something, he's playing the guitar. But the point is, after I gave that guitar to him, suddenly people started giving me guitars.
Magic.
It was just magic. It's like said, like a wartime Gibson J45.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, 1942, big baseball neck.
Yeah.
Vince Gill gave me a 37 L00 that I don't even know where it came from. Just influx of guitars that were given to me.
You've worked with Vince a long time on a lot of stuff, right?
Well, we go way back.
Yeah.
We go back to when we were both living out here.
Was he always an amazing guitar player? Because now he's like a transcendent guitar player.
Yeah, he was always an amazing guitar player.
It's kind of interesting about some of those guys. Because, like, look, you know, I'll be honest. Like, I had been sent a couple of your records, you know, a couple of years ago, some of the later records. But for the most part, in terms of country, you know, like I realize this about jazz too. If you don't grow up with it and it's not in your house all the time, and I grew up in New Mexico, it was around, but it was not how my parents were geared or my family was geared. Like, I have the old standbys. Like, I got a lot of them. Mm-hmm. You know, George Jones, and I've got Patsy's records. I've got some Bobby Gentry records. All the basics.
Right.
But there's a chunk of time, you know, post, I guess, 72, 73, you know, after Willie and Waylon kind of break it open a little bit, right, where you kind of come in and fill out sort of what becomes modern country, right?
Yeah, I suppose you call it modern country. Yeah, that started to happen around 72.
Because I saw you, I was at Willie's 90th.
Mm-hmm.
And when you came out and, you know, did two songs, I mean, for me, it was like the highlight of the night. And I'm saying, like, I got that guy's records. Now, how does he fit in? Like, that's really where it starts for me.
Mm-hmm.
So now I had to, you know, kind of do this thing where I'm like, I gotta go through the whole Rodney Crowell arc.
You got to dive Rodney Crowell, yeah. Well, I've done it. It's a thankless job.
But what's interesting to me, though, is that, you know, coming, like, was there a point at the beginning, you know, when you start writing songs? Also, I want to ask you about that because, you know, I play and people ask me if I write all the time, and I don't even know where to start with that. I mean, I know how to write a poem, I guess.
Mm, yeah.
But where you grew up in Texas?
Mm-hmm.
And what was, you know, what was the stuff that was getting you going?
Well, first of all, my father was a what we would, you know, we call local singer. You know,
yeah,
local band. What now we call local bands. Back then, he was in East Houston, played the Ice Houses and the Honky Tonks on the east side of Houston. And
guitar player?
Guitar player and a singer. Better singer than me, my father.
Yeah.
But you know, a real child of the Depression era and disentitled. And it's like, well, I can't have a career.
Right.
And he did not write songs.
Yeah.
But God, he knew. But he had a wealth of knowledge of songs. And somehow he was a savant, I suppose, because he grew up on a sharecrop farm in western Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
And it would be Saturday night, he'd have to walk to a neighboring farmer's place who had a dry cell radio and listen to the Grand Ole Opry. But he could hear a song once or twice and have it.
But, like, what were the songs that were in his repertoire? I mean, is it going back, like, Carter Family stuff?
It was Carter Family stuff and
Jimmy Rogers?
Some Jimmy Rogers.
Yeah.
But it was more late Hank Williams.
Okay.
Hank Williams
happened.
Yeah, you were talking about Keith Richards. And my childhood, Hank Williams was Keith Richards. And we had 78s at the house. And when I was four, I think, I kind of got a little record player on the floor in these 78s out of the dust sleeve, and I could play Hank Williams. And I would amuse myself playing Hank Williams way back there. And, in fact, my dad took me to see Hank Williams when I was 2 years and 4 months old.
Yeah.
And I wrote about it in this memoir.
Yeah.
Now, I really do have a memory of an eddy of cool air coming down from overhead, and I have a memory of my father's wild root cream oil that he had in his hair.
Yeah.
But the rest of the memory was his, that he would impress upon me, which was always, hey, never forget that I took you to see the Hillbilly Shakespeare. And he drove it home.
Yeah.
And
how was the show?
what I remember of it was
just that.
Was smell.
Yeah.
And an eddy of cool air.
Yeah.
But I wrote about it and stole his memory.
Okay.
You know, and wrote about it. But I think, given my mother, who both my parents were uneducated, they were seventh grade education.
Yeah.
Maybe my mother made eighth grade, but they were smart.
Yeah.
And my mother played with words. She just would make stuff up.
Right.
Just rhyme stuff. And,
yeah.
And my father just knew a million songs.
Yeah.
And so it seems like I was destined to be a songwriter if I think about it.
So the house was full of it.
The house was full of music.
Yeah.
And made up music and church music. And,
yeah.
And my favorite aunt, when we go see her up in Kentucky, those who could play would play and sing, and those who couldn't, they just moved the furniture out of the way and dance.
Yeah.
So I come from a culture of people who like to dance.
Uh-huh.
Dance to music that we were playing on acoustic instruments. And maybe somebody would have spoons and play spoons. And
well, it's interesting the communal aspect of it, because it really feels to me when I see stuff and I hear stuff of that era that there was a real sense of relief and ecstasy from whatever situation people were living in by doing those kind of group music situations.
Yeah, I suppose. When you don't have anything else.
Yeah.
You know, when all you got to look forward to is getting some seeds in the ground and growing something and hoping for the best.
Yeah.
And then when somebody might have a dry cell radio, 5 miles down the road, you could pick up the Grand Ole Opry. That was the culture.
Yeah.
That really country music came from.
Yeah. And when do you start writing songs?
Well, good ones.
No, I mean anything. I mean, like, I, it's so weird because when you listen to Hank Williams, the sort of simplicity and perfection of most of his songs, it's daunting because there's part of you that thinks like, well, I can do that, right? Yeah.
Well, you have to remember as a songwriter.
Yeah.
I have to cut myself some slack because when in 1947, 1948, when Hank Williams started writing those songs, the very simple love songs was still new, especially in that Southern culture, that country culture.
So he was
I'm so lonesome I could cry, or, your cheating heart.
Yeah.
That was new. By the time this early 70s came around, Bob Dylan had been around and
sure.
Christopherson, it was that simple song had already been done. And it was a different thing. So
that's interesting. So you're saying like that previous to Hank, there were themes, but they weren't innately personal in a way.
I would say they're more broad stroke.
Yeah.
It's broad stroke, simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, today I passed you on the street and my heart fell at your feet.
Sure.
Hank
Almost
Williams.
A pop song.
Yeah. And it's like, it's going to be hard to get a song started with that line now, or a line that simple. They're out there, but
right.
You got to work to get them.
But a lot of the traditional country that your dad grew up with was, some of it was spiritual, some of it was, almost, I imagine, some of that stuff almost seemed like it had like a English or Celtic folk songy kind of element to it. And it feels like that Hank kind of made it almost teeny bopper music in a way.
Well, he made it sexy.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just by his stance.
Yeah.
To me, that's why I say he was the first Keith Richard kind of rock and roll star come out of country music.
And he lived it.
Because he was lascivious, he was dangerous.
Menacing.
Yeah, he was menacing. And, one of the things about the culture where my parents came from that influenced me way back there is ghost stories and, really beyond, beyond reality was a big thing. The church was so much about beyond reality.
Yeah.
A red guy with a sharp tail and a pitchfork.
Sure.
Songs about that, it's like,
right.
Like if you're not careful, that guy's going to come get you.
And he believed it.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people did. I never did, but I come from people who still.
Sure. And when do you start kind of becoming aware of the task?
I got to Nashville in 1972, and I got there. I'd already started writing songs, but there weren't any good ones. I hadn't written any good songs. They were really sophomoric and hadn't gotten there yet. But when I landed in Nashville,
yeah.
I bumped into a songwriting salon, really,
yeah.
That Guy Clark and Towns Van Zandt, and this was post, when Kris Kristofferson made poetry, or the quote-unquote poet,
yeah.
popular in Nashville at the
yeah.
time, because he sort of gave Nashville what Dylan had given the rest of the world. So by the time I got there, songwriters were gathering around in Nashville because it was like, hey, you can kind of chase that poetic side of things if you got an intuition or an inkling of how to do it, and you can make a living here.
And so, but that was almost like, you know, I was thinking today that around the same time that everything changed in movies, you know, from old Hollywood to Easy Rider,
mm-hmm.
this is around that same time.
Yeah.
So, well, right?
Cultural shift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so when you're hanging out with Towns and Guy, I mean, were you aware, what was there sort of, you know, traditional country bearing down on you?
Well, I got to hang with those guys. My songs weren't good enough, and I was smart enough to not try to send my songs out there. But I knew Appalachian Dead Baby songs, and I knew, you know, I knew these traditional great old country songs that I learned from my father.
Yeah.
May I sleep in your bed tonight.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or may I sleep in your barn tonight. And,
yeah.
And when it, in the circle, when it would come around to me, I could pull out one of those songs and hang in the circle for a minute, because the authenticity of what I knew kept me on a spot there where I could learn more from these guys, because that's when I first, you know, Towns sat there and, you know, gave me a lesson in songwriting when he played Pancho and Lefty.
So first, he had that already in 72?
It was about end of 72, the first time he played me that song.
Oh, my God. And what? How did you react? So,
well, the way I reacted is, oh, this is what you have to do.
Yeah.
If you're going to hang, and if, you know, if you're going to be worth your weight here, this is what you got to do.
And had he been, were people recording his stuff already?
Not so. He was more the rambling, gambling folk singer who would come into town. And Guy Clark was the curator of this kind of Paris in the 20s kind of thing happening in Nashville. And Guy was a curator, and he and Towns were good friends. But Towns was out on the road, would come in back into Nashville and kick his heroin habit for a while. And then when he would come down finally, and all the songwriters would be sitting there with their guitars on their lap and stuff, waiting for Towns to come down. Meanwhile, we've been playing each other our kind of mediocre songs.
Sure.
Except for Guy, he was playing, you know, L.A. Freeway and good stuff.
Yeah.
And then Towns would come down and kind of straightened out and lay something on us, and it was like, oh, shit. Okay, and you know what? That's how I learned.
Yeah,
I mean, I had a background from my father and my mother, from the culture I came from. So I was a born songwriter. I own that. But being around those guys, it was like, ah,
that's it.
This is what I want
to
do.
For me, like, you know, when I listen to Towns, the weight of his spirit is sometimes too much for me even to take. Yeah, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think I do.
You know, like the songs are what they are, and some of them are pretty heavy-hearted.
Yeah.
But, you know, on different records, you can hear it in his voice that the sadness is real.
Sadness is real. But there are times when when he would have levity, and it was as if the songs, the writing just grew out of the ground or dropped down from somewhere in the ether.
Wasn't that kind of how it happens or in general? I mean, like I saw Dylan, you know, that famous interview where Ed Bradley's grilling him. It's like, well, you know, you once wrote, you know, these, I don't even remember what his examples were, you know,
it's all right, Mom, I'm only bleeding.
Right,
you take your pick.
Right. Well, Bradley says, like, you know, do you think you could write those again? And he's like, no. And Dylan says, I don't know where that came from. I couldn't write again. And I'm paraphrasing. Bradley goes, well, do you want to? And he's like, I did it once. You know, like, you know what I mean?
I'm sure he wants to.
Sure.
Who wouldn't want to? Any writer wants to. But it's something I've given consideration to, which is I wrote some songs in my early 20s that were like – Till I Get Control Again, or I Ain't Living Long Like This. Or
it's great songs. Those are great.
There are a handful of songs that I wrote in my early 20s that were sort of like capturing, you know, lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
And in as much as my talent was able to translate whatever that was.
Yeah.
Where in the case of Bob Dylan, he was writing, you know, It's All Right, Mom, I'm Only Bleeding, or Mr. Tambourine Man, or all that brilliant stuff.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That early 20s bolt of lightning that comes down, it's, if you stay in the game long enough, you got to learn how to do it. It's where that kind of inspiration is a gift from on high, and then if you stay in the game, you got to learn how to, through hard work, to muster up that kind of inspiration. So it's like, you know, in the songwriting game for me, is what's happened is that I've had to, I have to earn my inspiration now by getting up every day and going back to work.
And what, and but like, so when you're younger, I guess it's the same with what I do with stand-up or anything else, that, you know, you just kind of, all you're doing is walking around with a notebook and you're waiting.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you're writing anything that comes into your head and you don't even know where it fits in, right?
Yep.
Do songs come to you in completion, or are there bits and pieces?
They have come to me fully formed. It's rare, but a few have come fully formed. A lot of, you know, early on in the game, I wrote three quarters of a song several times. One of my biggest ones was Shame on the Moon that Bob Seger recorded.
Yeah, of course.
The last verse on that song was terrible, and is, and it still is. You know, I spent what?
That was a big hit for him, wasn't it?
I know, but I spent the last 45 years or whatever trying to fix that last verse, and so much so that I just rewrote the whole song, kept the chorus, and then threw out the read. So
you do a new version of it?
Yeah. The last verse did not work. Now, I when I talked to Bob about that, he said, "Nah, man, it's a good verse. It's a good verse." But another songwriter who recorded it, who's gone, a guy named Mac Davis, he's not here anymore.
From Lubbock.
Yeah, from Lubbock. He recorded it, and I bumped into him at some kind of affair, you know, and he said, "Hey, Rodney, I recorded your song. I sure wish I'd have been there to help you with that last verse." And I know he was taking it out of me, right? But I just grabbed him and hugged him, and I said, "Finally, somebody who knows that that last verse stinks."
Did he get a hit out of it?
No. Seger had the hit.
What Mac Davis album was that on? I remember his hits, "Baby, Baby, Don't Get Hooked on Me."
Yeah,
and,
"Lubbock in My Rearview Mirror."
Oh yeah,
was his song.
Did he write those?
Oh yeah, he was very. He wrote a lot of songs.
Yeah. Now, how did that work, like, when you got there? Because, like, now, when you guys were sitting around, did you ask each other for tags, for lines, or hooks, or, you know, help on things? Like, or wasn't it that kind of thing, where you just competed?
No, I mean, well, certainly with the early days when probably the most generous songwriter I've ever been around was Guy Clark.
Yeah.
And he just was... welcome the conversation. Come over, you know, what Guy would do, he'd say, "Come over, you got a new song."
Yeah.
He said, "Now put the guitar down, look me in the eye, and tell me the words to your song."
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, I'd do it." And those, the time when I'd have to look away, because he had these like piercing eyes.
Yeah.
It's like when I couldn't look him in the eye and deliver a line, I knew that line had to go.
Yeah.
And it was a very generous thing to do, but it was also really daunting.
Because in that moment, you realized it wasn't honest?
It wasn't honest.
Oh,
and
man,
even if it doesn't all have to be honest, but if you got three good lines and then a fourth line that's not a good line, that you're just cobbling together.
It's kind of lazy, I guess.
Lazy,
yeah.
Bad writing.
Right.
You say it to somebody, look them in the eye. If you really respect who they are, it's like, man, you know, you don't want to, you know, subconsciously or even consciously, you know, you're trying to whistle and pass a graveyard with a bad line.
Yeah.
And that was such a generous thing to have as I was forming as a songwriter. It what it led to is self-editing.
And so is there a point, though, where, because look, man, I mean, you've made a lot of records, and I know... The one thing I know, like, the more I buy country records is that country guys make a lot of records. You know, I mean, but like, you know, like there's no end. Like, you know, every so often I'll go, what is this Willie Nelson record? When did this happen? It's kind of astounding.
Well, yeah, he stopped off in Abilene and made a record.
He's right.
Yeah.
Same with Waylon. There's a million Waylon Jennings records.
Yeah. Maybe that's as it should be. Probably, interestingly, like Johnny Cash was a great songwriter, but he became super, super famous, as you know. And so he was so busy being who he was, he didn't write songs anymore.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. So, because you made all these records and clearly, you know, you were gunning for something as a performer. But it seems that, you know, your songs were so frequently covered and revered and to the point where people were like, I'm going to record that Rodney Crowell song. Now, is there a point where you're sort of like, you feel like as a performer, you're kind of like, well, is anyone noticing this?
Yeah, last night.
Because when I saw you, I was like, holy shit, this is the high point of the night.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting about me in some ways because, and here's what I know about me, is I developed as a songwriter really far ahead of singer.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like the sound of my voice until I was 50 years old. And I made some hit records in my 30s. And I can't listen to them. I don't like the sound of that guy.
But do you like the songs?
Yes.
You know what's weird about, you know, like I think probably one of your biggest records is It's Hard to Find. Diamonds and Dirt.
Yeah.
Diamonds and Dirt. I can't find it. I mean, I can't find it on Apple Music. It's like the only one. And I think it's probably your biggest record, right?
Biggest selling record.
So, that's
it's
what
not
I mean.
My best record.
Right. But I mean, but there were like four or five hits on there.
Yeah, well, there's five number one songs on that thing.
That's crazy.
By me. Interesting, at the time, I had 15 minutes of stardom, you know, and at that particular
time. With that record?
Yeah. And
1988.
Yeah, I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready. And it was okay with me. I noticed that, you know, for instance, when you get out there and you get some hit records in the country field, then you got to show up at 7 a.m., with the local radio to the...
Oh, yeah.
You know, chipper.
Everything, sell those tickets.
Everything's going really fast, you know. It's like,
yeah, comics
really,
do it, too.
Yeah. And I would wander in, you know, kind of glazed over.
Sure,
like,
of course.
I don't want to be doing it. You know, it's like, I don't do this fast-paced shit.
Oh, you so know? You didn't know how to sell.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know how to sell. And it's like, I didn't want to be there. I like to write songs. I like to perform. I love music. This is what I do.
Yeah.
And you know what? All of those disc jockeys, they got to look at me pretty quickly and said, this guy didn't want to be here.
Oh, yeah.
He's no help.
Yeah, that's right. All they know is just sort of like, is this going to be a pain in the ass? Is he going to ruin our momentum?
It's true. And you know what?
Well,
I would ruin their momentum. And, you know, for a while there, I was like, hey, what's wrong with these people? Don't they understand I'm an artist?
Yeah.
And then later on, as time went on, I started to go, oh, well, God, I was no help to those guys. They're just trying to do their job, and I walk in, and I'm all grumpy and, you know, snobby about, hey, this is all beneath me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because I loved Bob Dylan, and I loved all these great artists who didn't have to do that stuff.
I know what you mean, man.
You know, but I had to do it if I was going to be, you know, a big player on that level.
Yeah.
And luckily for me, I made a good living as a songwriter. And all of those songs that were covered by other people, and a lot of them, I can honestly say, the only time that I ever wrote a song for somebody, twice I did it. Once for Emmylou. And once for somebody else.
Jewel?
I wrote a song with Jewel. It was fun writing with songs with Jewel. But all the songs that worked, that got a job out there, I just wrote them to write the song.
For you?
Yeah. Well, just for the song. It's like the real, to me, the real act of songwriting is it's not for Rodney, it's not for you. It's like, what does the song want to be?
Right.
And I have, you know, I have people come to my songwriting workshops, and I always tell them, I said, look, I said, the whole key to this thing is learning to let the song tell you what it wants to be.
Huh.
Not for you to tell it what it wants to be. But that's my theory about it. I'm sure.
Because it reveals itself to you.
Yeah. It'll, if I'm patient enough, a song will tell me what it wants to be.
Huh.
I'll find the right words. And I'll find the right. The melody happens more quickly for me than the language does.
Yeah, that seems to be the trickiest thing. You know, if I'm to think about it, you know, I'm not a great singer, but I mean, melody seems tricky because, I mean, in country, I mean, how many chords are you really using? Four or five?
Yeah, you can use more. I mean, I come from the country, man, but I got some songs with 10 or 12 chords in them. I'm uptown.
But I mean, but a lot of them, they are, look, I'm a blues guy, you know, a rock guy, but I mean, the basicness, that's the amazing thing is that, you know, this is the people's music here. So, you know, you don't even have to be a good musician to necessarily make an amazing song.
No kidding.
Right.
No kidding.
Right?
Well, you know, the very best of Hank Williams and the very best of Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah.
Is three chords.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And they're the same three chords, really, just with a different tone.
Just a different way of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how you find melody that is unique within that is kind of a miracle. You know, anybody, mm-hmm. to find a unique melody within this sort of eternal three-chord process, within, you know, a major or a minor pentatonic, that seems like the hard part. Not for you, huh?
I don't know. I guess it's just intuition or just what I was born to do. I mean, being born in 1950 into the family I was born into, the real old-fashioned country music, and then I came of age in 1963, girls and social, and there were the Beatles, and there was Dylan coming right on that, and then... Yeah. Right on the tail of my being completely consumed with the Beatles and completely consumed with Bob Dylan in like 64, 65, right around the same time, Merle Haggard in 1965. So I was drawn to Merle Haggard as strongly as I was drawn to Bob Dylan.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Because what's appealing to them is that if they're resonating some sort of truth, you know, because Merle is certainly... kind of a rugged truth there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Dylan was sort of a trickster, but it was there in the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it was dazzling.
Yeah.
To me, it was dazzling.
But some people I talk to, they think that, you know, leaving Louisiana in the broad daylight is like the best country song ever.
Well, it's unique in that sense. If you analyze the song.
Yeah.
Interestingly so, the opening line, Mary took the running with a traveling man. I wrote that up in Laurel Canyon, and I was making a record with Mary Kay Place when she was on the old...
Mary Hartman.
She's a country singer. Yeah, she's a country singer.
Right.
We were making a record with her, and we were... The session was over. It was late at night. We were up in Coldwater Canyon, and we were talking, and Mary Kay... would come, you know, she would just string lines together. She's almost like a savant poet in a way. And so the Mary Took to Running with a Traveling Man, the whole tumbling language that happened with that song came from Mary Kay. And the Mary Took a Running was Mary.
Oh, wow.
So I've always, you know, owe that song to Mary Kay Place.
Wild. That's the interesting thing about the evolution of I think country music during your lifetime is that, you know, there was a push to make it more broadly popular, I think. But then, like, you know, because I can see in some of your records that, you know, the style of production that was going on and what was sort of the thing to do in the 80s, mid 80s, late 80s, it's very different. It kind of gets in the way of authenticity sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose you're right about that. It's like the 80s was a pretentious decade, really. You know,
a lot of Coke.
Yeah.
Coke.
A lot of Coke and a lot of pretension. And look, I was guilty of pretension. It's like I had those haircuts and, you know, those shirts. And
they're right on the cover of your records.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, that
I don't know if it's pretentious as much as it is a little goofy.
You know, it's like Diamonds and Dirt.
Yeah.
There's a picture of me on the cover of that album, and I wrote a song about it. Actually, it was dinner time around the house, and I went over. I was going to put on Booker T or something,
yeah.
And I pulled out Diamonds and Dirt, and I looked down, and there I am,
yeah,
with a wife beater T-shirt on, with a bolo tie and a Levi jacket and skin-tight jeans. And,
yeah.
Toe-tip boots,
yeah,
you know, and I looked at it closely, and I went, this guy's walking down a dirt road. You don't dress like that to walk down a dirt road. I thought it was the most pretentious thing.
Is that the song? Did you do a video from one of those songs? Was that the album where you're out in the middle of nowhere?
Of course.
The guys?
Yeah, we drove it into the ground. But I turned the album to my wife, Claudia, across the way, and I said, poser? And she said, well, I'm sorry, but yeah.
Yeah. You were just doing what everyone else was doing. I mean, that was the way people dress. You got the skinny tie and the sports jacket.
I went back in the back of the house after that and wrote this song called I Don't Care Anymore, which took care of that.
When I listened to, those songs you did with Willie that night, which ones of yours did he do? Did he record?
Several.
Yeah.
But the one of them that I did was that he did that I sang that night was Till I Gain Control Again.
That song, like, you know, I listened to a couple versions of it, and it's like, you know, I don't to some because you know, that can mean so much.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about the language of the idea of until I can because like you get to a certain age and you're thinking like he had a stroke.
Well, yeah, that could happen.
Right? And then, like, if you look at it another way, it's sort of like...
So you're saying it's timeless?
Kind of. It's timeless in the sense that, like, till I gain control can mean anything.
Yeah.
It could be money, it could be drugs, it could be booze, it could be health.
Yeah.
It could be, you know, your sanity.
It could be trying to write a good song.
It
could be trying to seduce a girl.
Yeah.
So, at that particular time, I'm pretty sure it was trying to seduce a girl.
Oh, yeah? When did you write it?
Well, sensitive language, you know.
Yeah, like, sure. Sure. and so, but that the element of songwriting that makes a timeless song, and I think that there seems to be a theme with you a little bit, is that, you know, no matter what you go through, you're going to end up in your own skin for better or for worse. And
sadly, you
know, right. And maybe you'll go through something again. Mm-hmm. Maybe you won't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
I may learn.
Yeah. Now, were these themes that you found in your life or are these because it seems like that, you know, country music deals with some of this stuff, you know, but I don't know that it did previous to Hank, what we're talking about now, but this sort of self-awareness of problems and obstacles and, you know, whether they're love or money or whatever, but there's the self-awareness of sort of, you know, realizing like, well, here I am and I did this. And,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I wonder, Chris Kristofferson was really, I think he brought on some of that looking at yourself because, Chris brought the bedroom into country.
Like
music.
Sunday morning coming down, that kind of stuff?
But also, you know, helped me make it through the night.
Oh, yeah,
Which, look, I'm straight up, I would have never written Till I Gain Control Again if I had not sung Help Me Make It Through the Night like 1,000 times at the Holiday Inn.
Yeah, right. And Kristofferson was like, you know, there are these guys like... There's like a profound, like, I guess what you said earlier is kind of true, is that like, you know, with guys like, you know, Towns and with Chris is that, you know, you had something that resembled, you know, real poetry, that there was a minimal language that could carry a lot of weight, like Leonard Cohen, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at all his stuff is lean stuff, man.
Yeah, well, it is lean, but it's so... beautifully written that it's
right.
It's timelessly heavy.
That's it. That's the trick, right?
Yeah. I mean, to me, I wasn't such a Leonard Cohen fan early on.
Me neither.
But the end of the last three or four records he made, starting with Waiting for the Miracle.
Yeah.
Came on a live. I had a live recording. It's like suddenly Leonard Cohen just grabbed me by the collar and
I think that
said, "Listen up, son."
Right.
And it's like he left breadcrumbs.
Right.
To me, and Dylan always has left breadcrumbs, as far as I'm concerned. But I think Leonard Cohen may have reached the pinnacle of it.
But it's like if it's an opposite approach lyrically, in a way. I mean, it seems to me. Well, there's a lot of fairly simple, perfect Dylan songs, but like Cohen never wavered. He was never about fireworks, right?
No.
Whereas Dylan, like, you know, he'd mash up a million words, and you were just sort of entertained by the flow of the thing, and then he'd put out like Blood on the Tracks, and then he'd be like, oh fuck,
yeah, right.
This is some pure stuff.
Well, yeah, I used to care, but things have changed. You know, that movie, Wonder Boys,
uh-huh.
Sitting through a movie, and then that piece of music comes on, and I go, God, there it is again.
Yeah.
One more time.
Do you use these guys to beat yourself up with?
No, you can't. No, man, it's inspiration.
Yeah,
it's like,
good.
I don't want to, as I always say this, I don't want to be like Bob Dylan or Hank Williams or anything, but I do want to access what they accessed. And, you know, whatever my wiring is, if I can access that place where that inspiration comes from or the creativity comes from, whatever my wiring in and whatever I'm able to make out of it is what I'm going to make out of it. And I can't compare what I do to what Leonard Cohen did, but what I can do is look at Leonard Cohen's work with so much admiration to say, I don't want to do that, but I want to do my version of that.
And when you look at your catalog, you know, which of the ones are ones where you're like, I nailed that one?
Oh, I started like 2001 when I made The Houston Kid.
That seems like to be the beginning of some sort of mature wisdom thing.
That was when I felt like until then, I felt I was a songwriter.
Yeah.
At that particular point,
mm-hmm.
I became a recording artist. And I stand by it. The work that I've done, you know, there was one or two duds in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
But for the most part, my output has been pretty consistent.
Yeah.
Starting with The Houston Kid.
And it seemed like you had a little more control of the production, maybe?
I had more control of my voice.
Okay.
As I mentioned earlier, I didn't like the sound of my voice until I was 50.
And what changed?
I lived in it. My voice got lived in long enough to have some bottom and some gravitas, really.
Yeah.
Because I would hear it. My father had a beautiful singing voice, and my mother squawked.
Yeah.
And I think until I was about 50, when I would sing, I'd hear my mother's voice.
Yeah.
And it wasn't pretty.
Yeah.
You know?
And what about, you were with Roseanne for a while.
Yeah.
Cash.
13 years.
And you guys are still friends?
Good friends, yeah.
Yeah. And you worked with Emmy Lou a lot.
A lot, yeah.
And when you work with these women in country music, and two big ones, and they would do your songs, or you would produce, you know, Roseanne's records, you know, did that inform you in any way in terms of some other part of yourself?
Yeah. I think it would go back. My first relationship with a woman was Susanna Clark,
mm-hmm.
Guy's wife. It wasn't a romantic relationship, but early on in the kind of songwriting salon that I told you about, Susanna was around, and she'd pull me aside, and she had some wisdom. And she was 11 years older than me, I think. And of course, I started coming on to her, you know,
sure.
Like, that's what you do. And
yeah.
She said, she'd hold her hand out and say, stop. I'm going to teach you how to be friends with a woman. Yeah. What?
Yeah.
And she did. And so, therefore, when Emmy Lou and I became so tight, and I knew how to be friends with a woman.
Okay.
And
she was just coming off of, had Graham died?
Mm-hmm. It wasn't long after Graham had died that our paths intersected.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And what, because she's an interesting artist because, you know, it's that voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you guys started hanging out, like, what was the foundation of that relationship? Did she gravitate towards your music?
Yeah, I think the only real reason that I became a member of the Hot Band, that original Emmy Lou Harrison Hot Band, was because I had a relationship with Emmy that was about songs.
Yeah.
We wrote some songs together early on, but our conversation was all about songs, and we would just sit and play, and I knew all the old Louvin Brothers songs.
And those harmonies.
In truth, the relationship that she had had with Graham that was taken away from her, we kind of had the same relationship as what she told me about the way she and Graham got on is Graham taught her songs and introduced songs. And that's mainly what happened with Emmy Lou and I. I wrote songs that she was recording, but also it's like we sat around and when she recorded Pancho and Lefty, I said, "Hey, you ever know this song?" And she said, "Oh yeah, I used to hear Town singing." And then next thing you know, she's recording it or Blue Kentucky Girl.
Uh-huh.
These songs that were just conversations.
What was the one yours she did? Bluebird, was it?
Bluebird One.
Yeah, Bluebird One. Yeah.
Yeah. She was, that was one of the first ones. And thank God, Emmy Lou, I mean, besides being my lifelong friend or adult friend, she started recording my songs. My career as a songwriter, Emmy Lou's the one that really kicked it off because her records were known, and some people looked down there and saw that little name that said, "Who's this Rodney Crowell guy?" And they went looking for the songs, and people started recording my songs. And
Crystal Gayle recorded, what did she make a hit of?
Till I Gain Control Again, yeah.
How'd you meet Roseanne?
Oh, Emmy Lou and I were at Waylon Jennings' house.
How was that, fun?
It was fun. It was a gathering at Waylon's house because Emmy was new.
Yeah.
Just breaking open, and I was her pal, and I traveled around with her, and we would sing duets.
You know?
It was like, well, you're going to Waylon's house, so Emmy and I'll go, and we'll sing a couple of Louvin Brothers songs, and that night, that one night, Roseanne was very shy back then, and I noticed her, and I remembered her, and that was in Nashville, but we both lived out here in Los Angeles, and she came to my 27th birthday party that somebody threw, and from then on, we were kind of connected.
Right.
Yeah, and then she asked me to produce. I wasn't a producer, but she had heard a bunch of demos that I made, and she said, "I want you to produce this record that I'm going to make for this German record company."
Yeah.
Which I did. It came out in Germany, and then Columbia signed her here, and they just hired me to produce her here.
And how was that for you?
It was fun.
Yeah.
It was painting by numbers. I didn't know what I was doing.
Sure.
We were just making it up as we went.
And she had a couple hits, right?
She had a bunch of hits.
Yeah. That must have been exciting.
Yeah.
It was. And like, in those Waylon records from the early 70s when he broke away, was that around the time that you guys were hanging out?
Yeah, this would have been around 76.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember I was in Nashville recording with Guy Clark, and Waylon came around, and he had heard I Ain't Living Long Like This, that song, and he said, "Hoss, you got any plans for that song?" And I said, "Well, it's on my album." I said, "I don't know." He said, "You going to put it out?" And I said, "Well, it's out." And he said, "I'm recording it. I'm going to make you a number one." And he did.
And so did you maintain relationships with these guys through your whole life?
Yeah, I did. Waylon and I fell out with each other accidentally. Over a road manager.
Wow.
Who was, we straightened it out because it wasn't.
Yeah.
But also, I got fired from producing a Waylon album before I actually got started because the head of RCA wanted me to produce Waylon.
Yeah.
So we went over to Waylon's house to have a meeting.
Yeah.
And both of us at the time were imbibing separate of each other on the white stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And
never good.
You know, it wasn't good. And so the head of the record label wanted to change Waylon's direction. He wanted me to do it. So
yeah.
I come waltzing in. Well, man, we're going to get a new rhythm section in the and he looked at me and he said, "Son, get out of my house." I drove home and
that was it.
I said, "Oh God, how stupid could I be?
Yeah,
let a record company guy make a fool out of me."
And Willie, you're friends with?
Uh huh. Yeah,
I had his son in here and it was pretty great.
Lucas.
Yeah, I've never.
Yeah, he's a talented boy.
Yeah.
Lucas and I have written a couple of songs together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was it like writing for Johnny?
Well, as you know, I never wrote for anybody.
Yeah,
But I, you know, because he knew I was around and he knew my songs, he would just pick one and record it. It was an interesting time in my life when I came into that family, you know, that giant of a man, you know, the man in black. And it was kind of cute, I think. And I think he was bemused at me coming around, you know, kind of drunken swag, trying to muster enough swagger to say, "I'm my own man. I might be married to your daughter, but I'm my own man. I need for you to respect me." And he just kind of looking like, "Oh God,
another one.
Give me a break."
Yeah, but how many of your songs did he cover?
I don't know. I don't know, man. I haven't thought about it. 4 or 5.
Yeah, that must be an amazing feeling.
Yeah.
Most of the time to hear.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, you like singing your songs, but to hear somebody like Johnny Cash or Willie Nelson or Waylon.
Yeah, exactly.
Do those songs.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine
it's
what
good.
That feels like.
It's a good thing.
Yeah. I remember the two albums I think that kind of defined that the shift in Waylon was that Honky Tonk Heroes.
Mm, yes.
And This Time. This Time is my favorite record of his, I think. I love that record. I think he did that at Willie's place.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Honky Tonk Heroes was a big one for me.
Yeah.
You know, to hear it and think, oh, yeah, there's freedom in here somewhere.
Right. But it seems to me that, like you said, with your records, like the Houston Kid, that began the run. Like, did you find any inspiration in what Rick Rubin did with Johnny?
Oh, yeah.
Because that seemed to be, you know, the way for what coming into your own voice at a certain age can look like.
Yeah, well, that's a gift from on high for John at the time because interesting thing about, I think maybe one of the best things I learned from Mr. Cash was the old Circle Star Theater up in Daly City going into San Francisco.
Yeah.
I was up there like 1980, gosh, I don't remember exactly. No, 79.
Mm-hmm.
He was playing there with the Carter June and the Carter family, and it's like 1,500 seater.
Yeah,
it's circular, and there might have been 300 people there.
Yeah,
and it was a low point, and so it went up, and I was thinking, oh man, I was really feeling sorry for him, you know, and it's like, oh, this is surely embarrassing.
Yeah,
but when the show was over,
yeah.
The black limo pulled in. He got into the back of the limo and sped away as if there were 30,000 people out there.
Yeah.
And I went, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the man right there.
Yeah.
And it just took Rick Rubin coming around, finding him and lighting a fire underneath that thing again.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful thing to watch.
Yeah.
And God, so much good stuff came out of it.
Yeah.
Hurt is one of the best pieces of recording ever.
Yeah. It makes you cry every time.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful.
But it seems like, you know, when Dylan hooked up with Lenoir, that there was, you know, there was something happening for artists at a certain age where their voice as it stood in its full maturity and wisdom was elevated.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Like Time Out of Mind. I mean, what the fuck was that? I mean, it's a crazy record. And then, like, even, like, I was listening to the record that you did that has, it's so Close Ties.
Close Ties, yeah.
That's a great record.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
You know, because, you know, it's, you're up front.
Yeah.
You know, and the music is just, you know, to kind of support what your voice is now and what your songs are now.
Yeah. I just had a kind of a similar experience going to Chicago and recording at Jeff Tweedy's studio.
Well, how'd that come about? Because, you know, I wanted to, you know, talk about that up front, but, like, you know, it's a great record.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm proud of that record. And it came about, I was driving home late one night. You know how when you drive home alone and there's no traffic and the car's dark?
It's the best.
And the music comes in and it inhabits the inside of your car.
It's the best way to hear music sometimes.
I was driving home, headlights, you know, and in my own, you know, reverie. And Jeff comes on singing, "I Know How It Feels to Not Be Loved," from his album Warm. And it was on NPR. And I said, "Wish they'd play that again." So I immediately bought it. You know, downloaded it, bought the record, I listened to it. We were on the Cayamo Cruise, a songwriter festival out on the high seas, and he was on it, and I saw him across the way, and I went over, and I said, you know, NPR sold me one of your records, because I was a Wilco fan.
Yeah, sure.
I had Wilco records.
Did you have those Uncle Tupelo records?
No,
that was kind of a country outfit, really.
I wasn't aware of that at the time.
Yeah.
But then I loved Wilco, but then I became fixated on Jeff from that. And I listened to that record over and over and over again. And I told him on the cruise, I said, "Man, I love that record." He said, "Well, come to Chicago sometime and record."
Yeah.
So one of my daughters is really involved in what I do, and we got in a conversation, and it came up, and she said, "Jeff Tweedy invited you to record at his studio." Yeah. And I said, "Yeah, we was just being nice."
Yeah.
You know, she said, "Get your manager to call right now."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, okay."
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it's like, "Yeah, let's make a record."
Yeah.
So, all right. You know, so off we go. I always wanted to record in Chicago for obvious reasons. Howlin' Wolf.
Sure.
You know, Chuck Berry.
Yeah. Muddy Waters.
Yeah. Everything,
crew. Yeah.
Everything that happened up there. And it was the Rolling Stones recording up there. And so off we go to make a record. And it was so much fun.
How was it different? Because, like, I know he's got, like, you know, he's kind of a magical analog guy. Like, you know,
we were recording digital.
Right.
But he has...
But I mean, in terms of equipment and how
his equipment is, you know, for a collector with drool.
Yeah.
And, you know, I took my main guitar up there and I wound up playing all of his.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's like, oh, God. He's, you know, God bless him. He's got some great guitars. But, but as a producer, man, he was the right thing. Right thing. Because he would never... He had no ego involved in how he works. He was just, you know, when something wasn't, he let us play.
Yeah.
As long as we were playing the song as it ought to go, he was good. He would come in, maybe play guitar with us, but then at that, you know, whenever he'd hit a roadblock, he would just walk out there and say, "Okay, you know, maybe you want to do this, maybe you want to do that." That simple. We'd do it. There it is.
Was there something different about the environment? Were you guys playing? Because, like, it looks like the way he's got it set up, you can play as a band. Was that happening?
It was all as a band.
Oh, that's good.
Well, I'm singing on a I walk in the studio. This is SM7 right here, these microphones.
Yep.
And, you know, in Nashville, we have these 251s and M49s and these great tube microphones that we sing in.
Yeah.
And Tom Schick, the engineer, as I walk in, he said, I'm sitting down behind this SM7. There's a 251 across the way. And I said, Tom, you're not going to put that mic on me.
Yeah.
And he said, no. And I said, why? He said, because the electric guitar is 4 feet, amp is 4 feet over there.
Yeah.
He said, this SM7 is going to bleed a lot less.
Uh-huh.
And that was, and that's everything on that record. The only thing we overdubbed on that record was a few bits of background harmony, and Jeff put a banjo on one song. And that was it. Everything else is just live in the studio. And I'm at my best when I sing live.
Yeah. Because it's immediate, I guess.
And yeah, well, it's the phrasing. It's like your phrase, the music is happening, so the phrasing. If I get a track, when I produce my own records, oftentimes I'm listening to everybody else and not paying attention to what I'm doing, having to come back and sing later.
Yeah.
I'm not any good at it. It's like I need to be leading the band to really get the best performance out of me.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And then you chose, like, it's interesting because you did do a town song on there.
I did, and that—
A heavy one.
Yeah, it is. Well, I think I told you earlier I was sitting with Towns early one morning, and he played me. I played him. What happened is, you know that scene in Bringing It All Back Home? Or the Dylan movies in London.
Yeah.
And Donovan is on the floor playing like a pretty weak song.
Yeah.
And he finishes it up and Dylan breaks into She Makes Love Just Like a Woman.
Yeah, right.
Breaks Just Like a Little Girl. And it's like, oh God, he just slays the poor guy. Well, that happened to me with Towns Van Zandt.
With Poncho and Lefty?
Well, I played this really shitty song and Towns played Poncho and Lefty. Which slayed me. But then he also played No Place to Fall.
Yeah.
And when I was talking to Jeff, I said, I've never recorded a town song, and I want to record this song because I think I remember it exactly the way Towns played it for me in 1972.
Wow.
Now, whether that's true or not, that's how we went at it. I said, I remember exactly how it sounded.
Yeah, the feeling.
Yeah, and that's how I recorded it, like one take.
It's great.
And that's it.
It's great. How'd you choose the other songs on this new one?
A lot of them came from pandemic.
Oh, yeah?
I was holed up in my home studio, and during the lockdown was great for me.
Yeah.
Because I just wrote songs and monkeyed around back there in my studio and recorded by myself.
You didn't get sick?
Oh, I got sick. Yeah. I got plenty sick, but I got over it and got back.
Yeah.
So maybe most of those songs were written during the shutdown, lockdown, pandemic, and some of them had been around a little while.
You know, it sounds like he honored your thing. It didn't sound like a Wilco record. But, like, there are times where, like, I could hear, you know, there's one cut, I think, on the second side where he brings in a pretty menacing, muddy guitar.
Oh, that's me.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
That's great, dude.
That's me playing my guitar through a Champ. You got one, right?
Yeah,
there.
Right. Just breaking it up.
That was Tom Schick, the engineer.
Oh, yeah?
I was monkeying around with playing that guitar part, and Tom comes out and he tweaks the amp.
Yeah.
And I said, that's a little heavier than I normally get. And he says, yeah, it sounds great. So that, you know, I'm pretty proud of that.
It's great, man.
Yeah, it's like I never went that heavy before.
Yeah. It's time, man.
Yeah, it was time.
Yeah. So now what are you doing now? Are you just on the road?
I'm on the road.
A lot?
Yeah. Well, I'm in your neighborhood tomorrow night. I got a gig somewhere around here.
Where?
Some theater around here in Glendale.
Oh, the one right there? The Arden or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah, tomorrow night.
What is that called? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, and I was...
I got to come down.
I was in San Luis Obispo last night.
How was that?
It was fun.
Who's the band?
I got a trio.
Okay.
Yeah, it's got a violin slash fiddler.
Yeah.
An Irishman. Yeah. Great musician. And an Aussie guitar player. We're a trio.
Oh, yeah.
It's all acoustic, but it rocks pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Can I come?
Of course you can.
Okay, man.
You can be my guest. I'll put you on the list.
Oh, man. Big night. I think I can walk there.
You probably can.
Great talking to you, man.
You too. My pleasure.
There you go. That was it. Those are some, like, serious American voices on today's show. John and Rodney. You can get the Chicago Sessions. It's available wherever you get your music. Hang out for a second, folks. Okay, listen up. Full Marin listeners, we're doing a look back at the past year for the next few weeks. And this week we dropped an episode where we talked about some of the memorable moments from the podcast in 2023.
This was right at the beginning of the year, episode 1399 with Cat Williams, which
yeah.
I feel like is a great example of like a talk where both you in the moment while you were having it and then me, as soon as I started listening to it, we were both like, I think this is all bullshit.
Yeah, that was like one of the great amplified bullshit talks. But, you know, but we've had other guests like that.
Yes.
And I don't think that there's that it's necessarily all bullshit. But, you know, his perception of who he was or who he chose he was or how he sees himself now in relation to the events of his life, you know, he builds stories around them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and even when he's telling you them, you know, I know. You know, it's embellished, to be diplomatic, and so does he.
Yeah, right. Right. Well, what was the
crying hookers?
The story of how he became a pimp was because he showed up to a house where a pimp just died and the hookers were crying and asked him if he would please take over, sir.
Yeah. Or how he read every book ever
written.
Yeah,
what he said, like, I've read like 12,000 autobiographies.
Yes.
Like, it was a number that was physically impossible. It was like the number of days he's alive. It would not be possible to read that many books.
But to sit with that guy in whatever version he's going to give you was hilarious. Because, like, he chose, he was going to be like, I'm going to talk to Mark like a regular person. And then, you know, and then you're like, all right, so this is Cat Williams, you know, being a regular person.
Yes.
And sharing this version of himself that is highly intelligent, has done all the homework.
Yeah.
Was, you know.
Winston Churchill was his inspiration.
Sure. But there are bits and pieces of it that are so clearly true. Like, it's very easy in that conversation, which is what makes it great, to see that there is truth to all of it. It's just he's gone back and tweaked it a bit, you know?
Yes, exactly.
But that was one of those ones where it was just so fun to sit across from that guy and watch him do that to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that afterwards. Like, we were talking and you were like, I don't know if this is going to sound good or anything, but it was entertaining to me.
Yeah. To sign up for the Full Marin, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. All right, here, I worked hard on this guitar. It took me a long time. Here we go.
Thank you. everywhere.